You are listening to Right on Radio. That's 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Annie Harview. Tonight, Josh talks with Ananya Bhattacharya about his biographical work on John von Neumann titled Man from the Future. Born in Budapest at the turn of the century, von Neumann is one of the most influential scientists to have ever lived. Mic drop. Bhattacharya explores how a combination of genius and unique historical circumstance allowed a single man to sweep through a stunningly diverse array of fields, sparking revolutions wherever he went.
And I'm Dave Fettig. In the last part of the hour, I will interview Andrew DeYoung, St. Paul author of the novel The Temps, just out today from Turner Publishing. DeYoung's debut novel, The Exo Project, was a Minnesota Book Award winner. As I mentioned, DeYoung is a Minnesota writer, one of our own. He lives in St. Paul with his wife and two children. All of this is coming to you and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio. And now this.
To fully understand the currents running through our century, from politics to economics, technology, and psychology, one must understand John von Neumann's contribution in the last. The Man from the Future, the visionary life of John von Neumann, is prescient for understanding our present by learning about the remarkable mind who many have jokingly said was a time traveler, a Merlin-like character who quietly seeded ideas he knew we would need to shape our Earth's future. Ananya Bhattacharya, welcome to Right on Radio.
Hi, right, thanks, Josh. Pleasure to be here.
For members of our audience who aren't familiar with him, who was John von Neumann?
So he was a sort of genius's genius, really. He was born in 1903 in Budapest. So he's Hungarian to a wealthy Jewish family there. But he came to the States in 1930, and most of the rest of his, well, all the rest of his life has lived in America. He helped out on the Manhattan Project here. Oppenheimer, physicist Oppenheimer, invited him to join and said, "We're in desperate need of your help to build the atom bomb." And the Hungarians there were known for their amazing intellect and their strange accents. So they got this nickname of the Martians. And they were, you know, the joke was that with their funny accents and their superhuman intellect, they were clearly from another planet. But the Hungarians themselves, like Edward Teller and Eugene Wigner, they only recognized one genius really amongst them, and that was John von Neumann. So he's really beyond even the most famous geniuses of the time.
You speculate in the book about how what caused such a large group of individuals from a unique part of the world in Hungary to have this surplus of geniuses coming out of it. Was it partially because of the schooling that they went to? I know they had a very unique setup of the gymnasiums you talk about in the book.
Yeah, so there was all sorts of stuff going on. I mean, all of the people that we now know as the Martians, this group of special Hungarians, were Jewish as well. And von Neumann speculated that they felt a special sort of pressure growing up in Europe of the 1910s and 1920s, this almost will to succeed, or as he put it, face extinction. And von Neumann saw kind of the Second World War coming really early, sort of 10, 15 years beforehand, and he's predicting the war in letters. And he's also predicting that Jews could well be rounded up and slaughtered, and he worries about this in his letters. So when the offer comes through from Princeton in 1930, which is, you know, with an immense salary, he jumps at the chance and leaves. So there was this pressure which von Neumann felt to succeed. There was the special schools. So there was the Minter and the school that von Neumann went to, which was the Lutheran. Now, even at the Lutheran, it was because the Jewish families were so successful in Budapest at the time, the Lutheran school was actually dominated by Jewish students, but they were required to pay five times the fee of Christians. So, you know, there was certainly a very elite approach. There were private schools, you had to pay. And there was also an incredible maths teacher there who became so famous, Ratz, that there are streets in Budapest named after him. And he talent spotted von Neumann very early on and essentially exposed him to a university level curriculum. And he would be taught by university professors at Budapest University. I mean, you have to bear in mind that by eight, von Neumann had pretty much mastered calculus, and by 11, he was lecturing set theory to his closest friend, which is Eugene Wigner, who would later go on to win the Nobel Prize in Physics for work that von Neumann actually helped him out with.
Let's talk about that for a second. I mean, there's many anecdotes of the mental gymnastics he was capable of doing that I was familiar with before reading the book, but one of which is that he was capable of multiplying 2 8-digit numbers in his head at a very early age. But I was surprised, though, from reading this, that he admittedly was not nearly as skilled at arithmetic compared to his grandfather, and he was also a middling chess player. In your research, what stood out to you as the most surprisingly human aspect of his character?
Well, there are many. I mean, of course, I don't want to play up the freakishness, really, because when you look at stuff like his Wikipedia entry, that's what tends to stick out, right? But he's also this very human figure, and that's what came through to me. He's unusually human, and for a genius of his stature, and we really are talking about, you know, quite possibly the cleverest person that we know of in history. Now, he had his foibles, but what his daughter told me once, her mother Mariette, who's also a fellow Budapester, she was sick, so she told John von Neumann to, John von Neumann came up and said, "Is there anything I can get you?" And she said, "Yes, I would really like a soft boiled egg." So he goes, right away, dear. And he runs off downstairs to the kitchen, which he didn't really know at all. And half an hour passes. And so he came back upstairs looking very sheepish. And he said, "Mariette, the egg's not soft yet." So, I mean, that kind of gives you the slightly absent-minded, kind of clueless genius. He was also well known for a line in Dirty Limericks, and he loved drink, he loved rich food, and he became slowly more and more rotund throughout his life. So there's this distinctly human aspect of him, but and he loves America. He's essentially an optimist who likes money, and but that is at war with another aspect of his personality. So when he was growing up, there was a communist revolution in Hungary, and that was pretty brutal. But that was quickly followed. That lasted for about 6 months, and that communist government was then deposed by a sort of nationalist forces that came sweeping in. And whilst the communists had killed hundreds of people, this next brutal counter-revolution, as it was, would kill thousands. There was public hangings, and there was this terrible situation. And then, of course, he foresaw the rise of the Nazis. And for him, Germany was this perfect intellectual climate. And what he saw from afar happening in Germany absolutely erased any faith he had really in human decency. He would help his fellow scientists to leave. And throughout his life, really, without much credit, he would not really talk much about it, but he was constantly helping people behind their backs. And I think that, to me, was probably the most surprising facet of his personality, because there's one other thing that many people know about John von Neumann is that he supported a preemptive nuclear strike on the Soviet Union. You know, if you say to bomb them tomorrow, I say, why not today? If you say 4 o'clock, I say, why not two? And that's, you know, that would seem to portray him as this kind of almost ruthlessly logical figure, but I think there's a lot more to him than that.
We'll get a little more into that, I think, later on, but before we do that, what struck me in the book, I mean, we see him, I mean, you talked about his Wikipedia entry. In my mind, he's this child prodigy that just came to the world, just seemed to have a grasp and just was like a sponge and could pick up everything, but he also had a peculiar curiosity about the world. You talk about in the book how he asked his father if the brain had a primary language and how does the brain communicate with itself. Was this curiosity instinctual for Neumann, do you think, or a result of growing up in an intellectually stimulating household, or maybe both?
Yeah, I mean, it's both. It's difficult to grasp, you know, von Neumann's intellect really is a mere mortal, but he was so far above even, you know, people like Einstein. When people met him later on and compared him to Einstein, he was working at the same place, the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and everybody agreed that von Neumann's mind was just so much faster than even Einstein's. He may not have been quite as intellectually creative in some ways, although I think even that's been vastly underestimated. So I think he was definitely, you know, endlessly curious and partly self-taught. He plowed through kind of this 20-volume history of Germany and would, he had this perfect memory where he could recall pages and pages of it years later. And he would recount them whenever some vaguely relevant circumstance came up. But of course, he was also from this incredibly wealthy background. His father was a sort of self-made man. He was a banker, and later they won a title from the emperor. This was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so that's why they became von Neumann. His father surrounded him with, and his brothers, he had two brothers, with tutors from an early age. His father was an interesting figure because he didn't think maths would pay. And so later he would sort of pressure von Neumann to study chemical engineering. And they reached this compromise whereby the young John von Neumann would study chemical engineering at the ETH in Zurich, but he'd also do a PhD at the University of Budapest, because one degree isn't enough, and he was kind of catching up on chemistry at the University of Berlin at the same time. So it's a very rich background. His father was extremely well connected culturally, so they'd have famous mathematicians and writers of all sorts from Budapest regularly at the dinner table. His father was involved with various businesses, and so he would invite his three sons to sit in on these lunches and ask interesting questions to his prospective new business partners who he was having over. So yes, I think definitely both.
Early in his life, Neumann tried to save mathematics from the fallout of Bertrand Russell's set theory paradox. That is, if a set that contained all sets that were not members of themselves could only be a member of itself if it was not a member of itself, would not be a set. His approach to resolving this was, as you describe it, beautifully simple. How did he resolve Russell's paradox?
Wow. Well, Russell's paradox, I think the simple way to think about it is it's sort of like the liar's paradox. So if you say this statement is a lie, well, you know, if that's true, then it's false, and if it's false, it's true. You start to get into a tangle. And so the paradoxes that Russell and others were finding was in set theory, which is works as a sort of the language of mathematics, and it's still the language of mathematics today. Now, if you're finding weird paradoxes in the language that enables you to prove stuff in mathematics, you've really got problems. Because if you can't talk plainly about maths, you can't prove theorems. So maths is a little bit, it's not going to work. And if maths doesn't work, then what about the sciences that are based on it, like physics? So this caused huge ructions in the early 20th century through mathematics. So the problems came about when you started thinking about the set of all sets. So when mathematicians needed to be able to deal with infinities, infinite numbers of stuff, because if you want to prove something about, say, prime numbers, you want to be able to prove something about all prime numbers, and there's an infinite number of them. So set theory allowed you to manipulate infinite quantities of things, but then, you know, you had these paradoxes. And von Neumann's approach to set theory, he set out in a very short paper, actually, a modification of sort of the language. So you couldn't really talk about a set of all sets anymore. You had two different sorts of things, one which allowed you to talk about sets, and the other one was groups of sets, as it were. So you could never get into this tangle that Russell had found. And von Neumann's set theory is still used. This version of set theory that he came up with was modified, and it still forms one of the valid approaches to proving theorems in mathematics.
Just showing his breadth here and his work, soon after, von Neumann turned his attention to the rising conflict in physics, a proper model of quantum mechanics. How was Neumann, or what was it? What was his attempt to reconcile the different approaches between Heisenberg's matrices and Schrodinger's wave function?
Yeah, so von Neumann gets a draft of his PhD, which, you know, resolves some of these issues in set theory. He's got it done by, I think it's 22, and he has a draft earlier. And after this, he goes to the University of Göttingen, and he goes there really not because of quantum theory at all, but because it's the mecca for mathematics. It's headed by the mathematician David Hilbert, who's the most renowned mathematician of his time. So he goes there really to study under Hilbert. And when he arrives, Heisenberg, who's another kind of whiz kid, who's a year older than von Neumann, has come up with an approach to this new science, which is going to be called quantum mechanics. And it's called, his version of it is called matrix mechanics. And Heisenberg's interpretation of quantum mechanics visualizes sort of electrons jumping about within atoms, and the mathematics are sort of grids of numbers. Now, the problem is, just a year later, Schrodinger, who's working at the University of Vienna, came up with a completely different looking theory of quantum mechanics that seemed to be implying something very different was going on at the physical level. So Schrodinger's version was wave mechanics, and it visualized sort of particles as waves. And so, you know, there was no jumping about within the atom. There was no electron jumping about. And in fact, Schrodinger hated that view. But the problem was, both versions of quantum mechanics seemed to give the right answers. And so von Neumann looks at this mess, and he realizes and works out that, mathematically speaking, both versions are true. They're two sides of the same mathematical coin. And the mathematical formalism that he uses is called Hilbert space, which he calls Hilbert space after David Hilbert, his mentor. But in fact, he ends up doing a lot of the work to develop this mathematics that David Hilbert had originally invented. And then later on, so he leaves Göttingen quite quickly because he's only got a fellowship for a year. And over the next few years, he is developing the first really rigorous mathematical description of quantum mechanics. And that becomes extraordinarily influential, because when people start talking about the different interpretations of quantum mechanics, what does it mean? What's going on here? Von Neumann's approach becomes this kind of mathematical rock. You know, whatever else you say about quantum mechanics and about cats and various other things, you've still got to come back to this maths. Everything has got to work out in terms of this maths. And von Neumann's interpretation, this mathematical interpretation of quantum mechanics, was really the foundation stone of quantum mechanics, and it would be influential for decades and decades to come.
How did Neumann get involved in the Manhattan Project? I believe Oppenheimer recruited him, sent him a letter, and just made a very, very stern request of wanting him to be there. I feel like he could use him. He was invaluable, I think, to the project.
Yeah. So Oppenheimer's letter said to von Neumann said, "We are only in what can be described as desperate need of your help. We'd like you to come and work with us on what he described as a Buck Rogers-ish project, a Buck Rogers-like project." Because, of course, he couldn't tell him that they were building an atom bomb in the desert. Now, von Neumann, when he moved to America, as I said, he foresaw this war coming. And so he throws himself, as well as doing his pure math, he throws himself into mathematics that he thinks is going to be useful for the war. And much of that was the mathematics of explosions. Now, this is really, really difficult maths, nonlinear. There's various nonlinear equations. You have to come up with approximations to solve it. And he just threw himself into that as well as doing that. And he made himself pretty much invaluable to the US military. So at one stage, he was consulting for the Navy, the Air Force, you know, and the Army all at the same time, buzzing across the country in planes. And he, just before Oppenheimer calls on his help, he's actually sent to Britain for a wartime mission for 6 months for the Royal Navy. And what the Royal Navy were interested in was they couldn't figure out the mine laying patterns of German submarines. And von Neumann seems to have worked that out really quite quickly within a few days. So pretty much saving a lot of Royal Navy vessels from being mined. What else he did there, we don't know much about. But after 6 months of that, he gets this letter from Oppenheimer. And as a result of that, he comes back to the US and he ends up at the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos.
How did Neumann feel about the devastating effects after the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I mean, you quip in the book, he didn't have any moral scruples with selecting targets. And I know he's seen as this maybe calculating character, but there was a humanity there. And I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah. So von Neumann's contribution to Los Alamos was actually the implosion bomb, which in engineering terms was extremely difficult. It was the physicists there were described as how do you crush a can of beer without spilling a drop. So Feynman thought it was a terrible idea, but then von Neumann came along and he showed how it could be done. Now, in terms of his scruples, well, at the time, of course, during the war, people were, all the scientists, many of them were Jewish. They were terrified that the Nazis would get the bomb. And of course, they didn't. And that attempt by them didn't seem to have gotten off the ground, but many of them didn't know. But even so, that wouldn't have affected von Neumann's view, because he was already looking ahead to the Cold War. He was terrified of what the Soviet Union would do when they got hold of the bomb in large enough numbers. So really, that was what he was thinking about. You know, do you want a world where you have two powers with enormous numbers of nuclear weapons, or do you find some way to stop that? And his initial answer was, of course, this preemptive strike on the Soviet Union. And he seems to have maintained that for a few years. He argued for that privately and publicly. But then as soon as it became clear that the Soviet Union had, you know, more than enough bombs now, so that there could be no preemptive strike, you couldn't wipe out their nuclear capacity, he changed his mind. Now, he gave the impression of not being particularly troubled by this, but we know that that's not entirely true. We know that through his second wife, Clara Dan, who kept a journal, that one day he came back from Los Alamos. This was after really the bombs had been dropped. And he slept for 11 hours straight, skipping two meals. And she said that made her more worried than anything, because von Neumann missing two meals was almost unheard of, as was him sleeping for that period of time. And he woke up late at night, and he starts talking and yabbering, and he develops a stutter, which is a sign of massive nervousness. And he's talking about the fact that as a scientist, he feels like he has no choice really other than to work on these sort of lethal technologies. And, you know, he's a Democrat. He totally thinks that the US, in a world of, many evils, the US he would rather have as the devil, you know, as it were, and he was determined to help the US. And this was his commitment really to his new homeland. Now, during this garbling, as he was talking to Clary, and eventually she gives him, a strong scotch and a couple of sleeping pills to get him off. But before that, he's saying, he starts talking about technological possibilities. And he's really talking about the computing machines that he's now working with for Los Alamos. He's had a long interest in computing machines. And he thinks or implies that they will be far more powerful and more worrying in some ways than the nuclear weapons that he's helping to build. So this is kind of a turning point whereby he's still working with his friend Edward Teller on the hydrogen bomb, but really his attention and most of his mind is now focused in bringing computers, the modern computer, into being. And that's kind of what he does next.
So what is, let's talk about that then. What is the von Neumann architecture, and what was its significance in the history of computer design?
Right. So as von Neumann is traveling the country looking for computing resources for Los Alamos to do bomb calculations, he bumps into this guy, Hermann Goldstein, on a train platform. And Goldstein is also a mathematician, and he's joined the army at the outbreak when the US joined the war. And he tells von Neumann that he's working with a machine called the ENIAC. And the ENIAC is going to be the first completely electronic computer. And it's capable of, an order of magnitude more calculations than any of the other machines before it. But it's still not a modern computer. And it's not a modern computer because all of the computers that existed up until this point were pretty much designed for one job and one job only, and to rejig them to do something else, to run a different program, you had to rewire them in some way to run a different program. And von Neumann turns up, he's immensely interested in the ENIAC, but he starts thinking straight away of a different sort of computer altogether. And most importantly, because of this background in mathematical logic that he has, he's able to formulate this rather abstract blueprint of the modern computer. And that is now called the von Neumann architecture. And one of the main things that the von Neumann architecture has is a huge memory. And that memory can store both data and programs together. It's got a central processing unit and an arithmetic unit. And essentially, step by step, it fetches instructions, takes them to the central processing unit, executes them, and goes back. And this combination of big memory that can store data and programs, and this step-by-step serial approach to computing, that's the von Neumann architecture, and it's the basis of pretty much all computers today that you're likely to use, ranging from your smartphone to the laptop that I'm talking to you on. So
before he passed, Neumann started a book that he was unable to finish titled The Computer and the Brain. It discusses his view that the brain can be viewed as a computing machine, and he makes suggestions for potential realms of research with this. I was wondering if you could talk about that, and what did he predict of the future with this this nascent field of study?
Yeah, so he was constantly taking lessons from sort of neuroscience, from very early neuroscience. He was interested in the way neurons work in an abstract sense. And in fact, his whole computer architecture was described in terms of these kind of fake neurons, these very abstract neurons called McCulloch-Pitts neurons. And what von Neumann realizes, and this is on his deathbed, he's writing these lectures and he's getting sicker and sicker. He has cancer, but he's determined to try and finish these lectures. And in the end, he doesn't, but they're still incredibly revealing. He realizes that the computer and the brain are very different kinds of machine. The computer, he realizes, is massively parallel, whereas the machines that he designed, the serial machines, work quite differently in this step-by-step manner. And despite its, on paper, you know, the human brain looks pretty appalling in terms of its computational abilities when you line it up even against something like the ENIAC, which works incredibly fast. But because of this massively parallel architecture, the human brain can accomplish amazing feats that computers are still nowhere near accomplishing. And in fact, it's an insight that holds true today. And if you look at DeepMind and so on, the way these work are basically neural nets. So networks of artificial neurons that are in essence pretty much like the McCulloch-Pitts neurons that von Neumann used to describe his original computer blueprint. It was called the EDVAC report, but yeah, the von Neumann architecture.
And my last question for you, is there anyone that comes to mind in the 21st century that you see as being on par or as a mind being equivalent to something like John von Neumann's?
Well, I mean, this is a really difficult question. I think in terms of sheer computational power, there's probably going to be people out there from generation to generation. I mean, mathematicians like Terence Tao, for example, are really famous and seem to have had a similar kind of aptitude from a really young age at tackling these problems. But von Neumann was really, really special. And so I don't think there's really anybody like him. And I think he came at a historical juncture that also allowed him to achieve a huge amount. So since that early 20th century window, the sciences have exploded into speciality. It's an extraordinarily expensive occupation now. When you look across the range of the sciences, whereas von Neumann turned up at this, in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, he was there at the birth of the computer. He was there at the birth of quantum mechanics, and it's difficult to envisage now somebody being able to be so influential in the way that he was able to be. And lastly, he was a really unusual mathematician. So the mathematicians, when you talk about or read biographies of famous mathematicians, the work will be quite esoteric. it will be, you know, you'll be trying to explain their theorems in, you know, terms that a lay reader might understand. But the sorts of stuff that von Neumann applied himself to, he invented game theory as well, which would lead to Nobel Prizes a half century later. It also, game theory is also making billions for the tech industry, people like Google and Facebook. That sheer range of accomplishments, that incredibly practical mind that he had to be able to apply mathematics to the world. I've never come across anybody that that has that sort of aptitude within the world of mathematics.
You've been listening to my conversation with author Anono Bhattacharya, a science writer who has worked at The Economist and Nature, discussing his work, The Man from the Future, The Visionary Life of John von Neumann. Anono, thanks for being on Write on Radio.
Thanks very much, Josh.
And now this.
It is still pledge time at KFAI, and there is still time to pledge. You can pledge one of two ways, by calling 612-375-9030 or by visiting kfai.org. And the reason pledging is important is this is community radio. This is entirely publicly funded, entirely locally run. Most of us here are volunteers, a few people are staff, and we could not afford the equipment that we need to do this, to broadcast this out to the broader community without your help. Right now, we're here, we're talking about books on Radon Radio. Less than an hour ago, Somali Link Radio was in, bringing you current events from that perspective that you don't usually get on mainstream white dominant media. There's different programming from different culture every hour, and it's so fun and such a treat to be here. And I feel so lucky to live somewhere where there's community radio like this. And even just making our book programming, it's great because we're not sponsored by or beholden to anyone. We're talking about books we care about that we think matter. And there's nothing else to it.
Am I on?
I was like on my impassioned rant. I look over to Dave. His mic is not on. All right,
thank
here
you,
we
Annie.
Are.
Yes, Annie, well said. I don't have much to add to that. It's a treat to be here. I'm with you. To live in a community like this with a radio station like this is a pleasure. And we have with us this evening Andrew DeYoung, who's joining us live in the studio from St. Paul. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. We're here to talk about your new novel, The Temps. Before we start talking about that, let's learn a little bit more about you. We learned that you're pretty popular and famous. You're going to be on you're on our literary calendar of events. But tell us how you got into novel writing and your literary background, please.
Yeah, I mean, I like many writers, I suppose. I had dreams of becoming a writer for many years, struggled to maintain a writing practice until my late 20s, I think. It's kind of a cliche maybe, but I felt 30 coming, and I had this sort of silly idea that if I didn't do it by 30, I would never do it. So I just kind of forced myself to build a real writing practice and published my first novel some years later in 2017. That was a young adult novel called The Exo Project, which later won the Minnesota Book Award in 2018. Thank you. Some 5 years later, I suppose, book number two is coming out. This one is not young adult, is my adult literary fiction debut, The Temps. And so that's kind of my path, although, you know, lots of hard work and failure and rejection along the way, which is the way of life for any writer.
Yeah, a lot of writers listening, and I'm sure many can relate to that. So let's talk about The Temps. We're going to have a reading here pretty quick, but before we do that, do you want to set us up?
Yeah, The Temps is a book about I guess we can start maybe with one character, a young man named Jacob, who is a recent college graduate. He was an English major, struggled to get a job out of college, is ultimately living in his parents' basement. He gets a temp job at a rather large corporation, which in the book I call Delphi Enterprises. It's sort of hazy what the company does. He doesn't understand their business, but he knows that he's been hired in a position for the mailroom. He goes to his first day of work, where he learns that there's a big all-company meeting. The CEO is going to do a sort of a product rollout outside in a big amphitheater with, you know, thousands of employees in attendance. But he can't go because he's just a temp. Only the permanent employees are invited. So he stays inside. The rest of the employees go outside. So he's kind of alone in this huge office complex. And then during the meeting, where all the regular employees are outside, a sort of catastrophic event happens. There's a poison gas attack, and everybody dies. And it seems that this is happening elsewhere. It's sort of a global catastrophe, an apocalypse event. And he is left stuck inside, and he finds other temps, other people who are not invited to the meeting. And they just kind of have to survive in the wreckage of this company that employed them. They're stuck inside for, you know, days, weeks on end. And so it's sort of a survival apocalypse novel that also considers the working life and what it's like to be the youngest and probably most poorly paid person in a large corporation.
Well described. And I will say to the listeners, it is as much fun as Andrew sets it up to be, but also very, very thoughtful. So with that, we'll talk much more about it. Let's have your reading.
Yeah, I'll just start right from the beginning with the first line. The sky on the morning of Jacob Elliott's first day at Delphi Enterprises was clear and bright, untroubled by any portent of the catastrophe that was to come. And yet it wouldn't be accurate to say the day was cheery, not to Jacob, driving down a busy freeway surrounded by box stores and strip malls and the vast, untamed scrubland that dominated the outskirts of the city. The slanting early light had a strange quality to it that seemed to drain everything of its color, transforming the landscape into a kind of wasteland in Jacob's squinting eyes. As his car came closer to Delphi, a huge, nondescript office complex whose reflective windows shimmered like a corporate mirage in the distance, the traffic on the highway slowed, then stopped. The emotion that rose up in Jacob's chest at that moment was one of utter desolation. He was a piece of human flotsam in a river of metal and glass, inching toward a destination made of the same dead substances. Jacob wasn't looking forward to his new job at Delphi. The position he had taken was a temporary one in the company's mailroom. The fact that he'd been reduced to this kind of work, that he needed the job, even if he didn't want it, filled him with shame. He was a college graduate, for God's sake, a star student in the Department of English, the subject in which he'd majored. His senior thesis, The Game is Afoot, Game Theory and Social Control in Late Victorian Detective Fiction, had been published in an academic journal next to the work of PhD students, tenured professors, and postdocs. And he'd been waitlisted in several prestigious graduate programs, though not, a cruel voice from deep within his mind always reminded him, ultimately accepted to any of them, not even his safeties. But that was a long time ago, 3 years since graduation, during which time Jacob had worked a series of low-paying and sometimes no-paying jobs, barista, clerk, intern, assistant. Over roughly the same period, he'd shared an apartment in the city with a college friend. A former friend, really. Their relationship had been strained by the minor stresses of living together. Dishes piled in the sink, sharing a bathroom, the mechanics of bringing girls over, Jacob's perpetual inability to make his half of the rent. Then, 4 months ago, the roommate, a computer science major when they were still in school, landed an IT job with steady pay and informed Jacob that he'd be moving to a nicer place with his girlfriend. Jacob took out an ad for a new roommate, couch surfed for a couple weeks, then ultimately left the city and landed in his parents' basement. Jacob once felt that he was destined for some kind of greatness, had dreamed of fame as a writer or an intellectual of some sort, but the past 3 years had taken their toll. Now the thing he craved most was the same thing he'd once disdained, a white-collar job as a cog in the corporatist capitalist machine with a salary, health benefits, and a 401k. And so, when notification of the temp listing, a job in an office requiring no skills or experience, had buzzed on his smartphone, he applied for it at once. It may have been beneath him, may have been at a company whose business he didn't even understand. The website said something about research and intelligence and analytics, but it was at least adjacent to the kind of life he wanted. Not quite fame and fortune, but not another unpaid internship or fast food job either. And I'll stop there.
Great. That was Andrew DeYoung reading from his new novel just out today, The Temps. So this reminded me of a thought I had when I was reading this, that if we didn't know what you told us or didn't have that clue of what the book was about, we would believe and think, as I did mostly, this is going to be a great send-up of modern corporate office work and capitalism, if you
sure.
will. And it ends up being that with a lot of wild stuff
with
going
a lot
on.
Of other stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah. That first chapter begins as Andrew read it, obviously. And you think that's what you're getting. And then something hits the fan and it's really big. Let's start there. You decided to write sort of an apocalyptic slash dystopian sort of story. We love these things. They're everywhere in our lives, in our cultural lives. So how did you deal with that? And how did you place your narrative within these other narratives that, you know, are flying in people's minds when they think something like this?
Yeah, I think that I chose the apocalypse sort of theme because it is such a it's such a thing that preoccupies all of us. We are surrounded by images of the end of the world, or people imagining the end of the world, predicting the end of the world in different forms. So it was something that I was interested just in dealing with. What is it like to live in that kind of an environment? And of course, you know, I deal with that by literally making it happen in this in this book. But I also, you know, that first passage that I read, dealing with a young person taking a job that he doesn't want, I thought a little bit about sort of the existential crises that people in their 20s sometimes have when they're trying to enter the world and make a life for themselves. Mm-hmm. And that can feel like the end of the world on a personal level.
That's well said.
You know, you enter the world and
yes,
you
I enter recall the, those days.
You enter the adult world and you discover that it's not what you thought it was.
Yeah.
And also you are plagued by all these images of all the things, all the social ills, the cultural problems that might be leading us to the end of the world. And at least when I was that age and trying to establish myself as an adult person with a career, that personal sense of existential crisis and personal apocalypse and the fears of apocalypse outside, war, climate change, all the rest, they felt connected on some level. And so that's really what I wanted to play with in this novel.
You did that very well. And listeners, you can get a sense for how thoughtful Andrew is. It really comes through in his writing. I love the title, The Temps, in as much as the temps become the permanence, if you will.
Yes.
It's beautiful. You want to talk about that?
Not just the permanence, but like the permanence of possibly the whole world.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
They have been treated, well, and this is something that I think connects to sort of maybe a generational observation, which is that millennials and Gen Z people, as they enter the workforce, are dealing a lot more with the gig economy than prior generations have. So they are doing a lot more temporary work. The word temp, I don't hear it that often on an official capacity. People often talk about like contract workers.
Yeah.
But colloquially, you'll talk about the temp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of derogatory. The notion that they're not going to have a job for very long is built right into the word.
Yeah.
You know, they're treated as disposable.
Yes.
But there just seemed to be, it's something that excited me about the premise when it kind of popped into my mind, that the temporary employees, those who have been treated by the capitalist system as the most disposable, mm-hmm. become the only ones who survive. And who are kind of trying to figure out what's going on in the wreckage of the company that they've kind of inherited, and the wreckage of the world that they've inherited.
One of the many things I like about this book is that it actually talks about work. I remember reading an essay years ago, can't remember the literary critic at the time, bemoaning the fact that American post-mid-century novelists rarely, if ever, wrote about work anymore or real life. It was always what's going on in the lives and characters' heads. And he was just over it. Give me some America. Give me some real stuff. And this is thick with a real corporation. And I know what you do during the day. You can tell us about that. But you really plumb the depths of, in my mind, because I have some experience in larger corporations, you get it. Yeah. And it's in there. Do you get this intuitively, or did you have to do some research? And tell us a little bit about Delphi. Jeez.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can wrap all that together. My day job, I work in publishing. Yeah. You know, I don't work in a large corporation, but I do. You know, it's a medium sized company. I have worked at an ad agency before. Mm-hmm. You know, I have worked some of the jobs that Jacob worked. You know. I worked for like Caribou Coffee and stuff like that, mm-hmm. you know, when I got out of college. Mm-hmm. My observation is that, you know, when it comes to work, it's the way that most people spend most of their days. So it should be addressed somehow in fiction. Mm-hmm. And another odd thing about contemporary life that's not always addressed in fiction is that people have real relationships with the organizations that they work for or that they encounter. Mm-hmm. You know, corporations are a huge force in our lives, And we actually have, whether we want to or not, we have relationships with those corporations. All of us have like a relationship with Target, with Amazon.
Irrespective of whether we work for them.
Whether we work for them or not. Yeah. And the one that you work with, you definitely have a relationship with because you are there, you're kind of imbibing a corporate culture mm-hmm. that worms its way through the whole thing in very insidious ways. It's not always a negative corporate culture, but it's there. Mm-hmm. So I think that I'm just kind of a student. In all the jobs that I've had, I've just been very interested in the way that the corporate culture expresses itself mm-hmm. and the relationships that people have with the companies that they work with. You know, I've had, like, back when I worked as a barista, I had managers who hated corporate, who were definitely corporate people, you know, all those different things. There's true believers, and there's people who just say, you know, this is just a day job. It doesn't have anything to do with who I am. Mm-hmm. Whether we want to or not, we all have this relationship with the entity that is the organization.
Yeah, that's well said. Andrew pointed up when he said the entity. And
as if it's like a godlike entity.
Well, but that's how you treat it. And you use metaphors, Greek mythology, these words, Delphi is the corporation. And it comes through time and again. This is obviously purposeful on your part.
A happy accident in some ways, although once I discovered it, I kind of leaned into it, that I was creating, I was creating something that was sort of godlike. Or mythic mm-hmm. with Delphi, because of that of course refers to Greek myth and the Oracle of Delphi.
Yep.
But initially I was really interested in this notion that the young people in my book, the people in their 20s, they're working, but they don't yet understand the economy. They don't yet understand mm-hmm. the company that they're working for.
Yeah, that's brilliantly done. Yeah.
Because I think, and actually there's a lot about the economy, about the ways that companies make their money that I don't understand.
Right.
And so I wanted to think about, like, what's a company that I kind of know them, I know their brand, I know, like, I recognize the name, but I don't actually have a great sense of what they do. Mm-hmm. And one that occurred to me was the company Oracle.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to call it Oracle because that's an existing company. So I said Delphi.
Yeah.
And, but then I just kind of made it, a stomping ground for a bunch of different things, a bunch of different disparate businesses mm-hmm. where the temps, the characters are just getting little bits of what the company does, mm-hmm. but they can't put it into a coherent whole. That was interesting to me thematically because I feel like that is how an individual human experiences the 21st century global economy. It's yes. hard to understand the whole thing, the whole machine. Mm-hmm. But also, it becomes a plot element as well, because there's a mystery to it. Like, what is this company actually about?
Yes.
And some characters are interested in that. Some characters do not want to know.
And to push that even further, talk about that a little more in terms of religion, you have certain employees who are trying to really figure out what's going on. What is the CEO really thinking? It's almost yeah. as if they're reading the holy texts in various different ways, interpreting what does he really want? What is he really thinking? It's really nicely done.
Well, and if you think this is silly...
No, not at all.
I'm more to the listener, because yes. I think, you and I are probably on the same page, but this definitely happens in companies. You know, the boss, the big boss will fire off an email, and then everybody else will gather together and be like, what did he mean by this? We need to parse this text as though it were holy.
It's so
scripture.
True.
Yeah.
It's so true. And people come up with weird ideas and theories.
Right.
And I won't name names of places where I used to work, but that is exactly how some companies are run.
Yes,
trying
absolutely.
To divine what whoever the leader is, what that person wants. So you obviously have an interest in tech, or maybe you don't, but you got a lot of things right, I think.
I
mysteries
hope so.
Of tech. It's all
well, my
emissions and.
I'm not going to say that I'm especially tech savvy. I try to keep my finger on the pulse of what's going on. I've certainly paid attention to, like, you know, what Facebook and Amazon and Google seem to be doing. I don't know many of the ins and outs, but I've done some research. But my observation is that tech has bled into everything.
Mm-hmm.
I know people who work in, like, education, who will talk about educational experiences and they'll talk about beta testing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even in publishing, we'll talk about end users sometimes, or, you know, like, it's just, it's gotten into the water.
Yeah.
The sort of ideology of tech capitalism yeah. is it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. Even if you don't work in tech, my more specific interest in technology and in tech capitalism is the ways that it influences our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Because the devices that we carry around with us, I mean, just to pick a very small example, are spying on us in ways that we don't even understand.
Yes.
And we're kind of willing victims yeah. and participants in that corporate surveillance state that we all live in.
Mm-hmm. And lest readers get the idea that this is a really serious, thematically laden sort of book, which it is in a very smart way. It is funny.
It's funny, I hope,
it's
yeah.
It's funny. It's funny. The characters are real. They're young and they're funny. And but it's also got a lot of wild... there's some good violence in there. There's gore. I mean...
Right in the first chapter.
Right in
so,
the
I
first
mean, brace,
chapter. So,
brace yourselves. It doesn't get any worse than what's in the first chapter.
That's right.
It's a bit more tame for the rest of the novel, hopefully.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. To say that there's a gas and then people die, that doesn't begin to describe
no, really
what happens.
No.
No. You want to read that. I mean, if you like that sort of thing. We're running out of our precious time already, believe it or not, Andrew. So... Look at that. Annie is
we've been given more time.
Oh, my
How
God.
Nice.
By the great, I'm raising my hand. I'm pointing up to Annie. tell us about, I want to make sure we talk a little bit about your first book.
Yeah.
You did so well with that. Tell us a little bit about that. Remind us again of the title.
Well, it's called The Exo Project. It is a book about, it's young adult fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So fiction for teens. It's kind of on a similar theme, although not quite as corporately minded
mm-hmm.
and not as satirical, but it's very much it also considers a future Earth that is sort of ravaged by apocalyptic forces. In this mm-hmm. case, it would be climate change, and a sort of mission to find a new home for human civilization that brings. Two characters, one human and one sort of a humanoid alien, mm-hmm. In contact with each other, and considers what happens when cultures collide, and if there can be any possibility of sort of a peaceful version of that, of cultural collision, when one of the representatives actually comes with the expectation of colonizing this planet. So it's a pretty like complexly plotted book. Mm-hmm. Not quite as funny, but pretty heartfelt, I think, and still, you know, a lot of big ideas there, big mm-hmm. juicy ideas. Mm-hmm. In spite of it being for young people, you know, young adult fiction can be as thematically complex as adult fiction.
Absolutely.
And I was really proud to have won the 2018 Minnesota Book Award for that that book, which was a fantastic way to get started.
How do you know when you have a YA novel versus an adult novel? What's the thing that makes it YA?
That's a really good question. I think that for me, and it's going to be different for each person, but for me, it really has to make sense for the characters to be young people, and on some level, that means that the question of kind of like moving from childhood into adulthood mm-hmm. are being considered on some level.
I see. Sure. Gotcha.
So the EXO Project was very much a sort of like looking to the stars and wondering if there's anybody out there for you mm-hmm. and sort of like metaphorically like meeting someone, kind of like a first love kind of story.
Right.
But also some disillusionment with the sort of adult adult generation. I suppose The Temps in its way is similar in that it considers young people moving into adulthood.
Yeah.
But it very explicitly and deliberately considers young adults, people who are in their mid to late 20s. So on that level, you know, since this book is so deliberately thinking of itself as something that tackles a certain time of life, mm-hmm. It was just obvious to me that this would be something that would be for adults. Although I think that, you know, teens could certainly enjoy this as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even think about it. And I try to think, we all in this room and listeners think critically about what we read, but the idea of that this is a novel about young people mm-hmm. and stuff happens to them, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And beautifully told. We have a little bit of time. What are you working on next? You must be working on something.
Well, I've got a few things in the can. I've always got some things that I've finished.
Wow.
Considering what might be next. So I've got a couple more somewhat dystopian concepts that I'm kind of tinkering around with.
Awesome.
And waiting for one to kind of grab me and say, let's, you know, I'm the one, not this other one.
Yeah.
And still kind of not there yet, but we're gonna pick one soon.
Well, that's awesome. And we hope that we hear about that. We will. And we'll have you back. Congratulations, Andrew, on this book. It's been a pleasure. Andrew DeYoung. The book is The Temps. It's getting a lot of love. Nice review in the Star Tribune this weekend. Look it up, folks. Google that. And look it up, The Temps by Andrew DeYoung. Andrew, a pleasure to
have you
here.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.